This Restorative Justice Life is a production of Amplify RJ. Follow us on all social media platforms at Amplify RJ or sign up for our email list to stay up to date on everything we have going on. And to get the most involved, join our free Mighty Networks community to get connected with others living this restorative justice life all over the world. As far as this podcast goes, make sure you're subscribed, leave a rating and review, and share with a friend to help us further amplify this work. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to This Restorative Justice Life, the podcast that explores how the philosophy, practices, and values of restorative justice apply to our everyday lives. I'm your host, David Ryan Barcega Castro Harris, all five names for the ancestors, and I'm the founder of Amplify RJ. On this podcast, I talk with RJ practitioners, circle keepers, and others doing this work about how this way of being has impacted their lives. Angel, welcome to This Restorative Justice Life. Who are you?
I'm a son.
Who are you?
I'm a friend.
Who are you?
I'm a father.
Who are you?
I'm a brother.
Who are you?
I'm a mentor.
Who are you?
I'm an ex-gang member.
Who are you?
And I'm a work in progress.
Thank you so much for being here, Angel. We're going to get to the intersections of so many of those things right after this. Hey, y'all. David here. If you listened to This Restorative Justice Life last week, you heard that the episode with David Yusum was Elisa's final episode producing this podcast and having an on-air role. She'll be supporting us behind the scenes, and we've got some new people who I hope to introduce to you soon helping this podcast run. So big shout out to Elise for all the work that she's done from this community over the last year and a half. As we're approaching 2 years and 100 episodes of this podcast, we're reevaluating some things and some changes will be coming soon. But we definitely want to take your perspectives into consideration. So if you have any suggestions for how we can improve, any guest suggestions, or just want to drop us a line, email us at media@amplifyrj.com. Also, if you're listening to this podcast on the day that it comes out, September 15, we're just 1 week away from a live conversation that I'm hosting with New York Times bestselling author Britt Hawthorne. I've known Britt for over 2 years now, and she's been a big supporter of the Amplify RJ community, introducing us to so much of her audience. She is a former classroom teacher who has moved into the anti-racist, anti-bias educator space, working as a consultant and facilitator of this work. She recently released her book, Raising Anti-Racist Children. So in our conversation on Wednesday, September 21st, from 4:30 to 6 p.m. Pacific, make the translation to your time zone. We'll be talking about her journey with anti-racism work, what she's learned as a teacher, a facilitator of this work, and most importantly, a parent. It's a really important conversation for me as I am now the parent of an almost 6-month-old. And while so much of my work is just about keeping diapers clean and making sure that there's no aspiration of food, I want to instill values of anti-racism as well as restorative justice in my kid from jump. So wherever you are on your parenting journey, including reparenting yourself, join us for this conversation. Links to that, all our other upcoming events, and all our courses, all the other ways to get involved in our community and on social media are in the show notes. Now, so excited to bring you this episode with Angel Garcia. Let's get to it. Thank you again, Angel, so much for being here on This Restorative Justice Life. You know, you are one of many people who have been on this podcast since the NACRJ conference back in July. I think we were in a session together talking about, like, quote-unquote non-traditional participants in restorative justice, and some of the things that you were sharing was like, yo, I gotta get this guy to tell his story here on our airwaves. So I want to ask you to do that in just a moment, but it's always good to check in at the start of these. So to the fullest extent that you want to answer the question right now, how are you?
I'm great. You know, I could honestly say I'm blessed. Life has never been better. I'm grateful for everything I have and everything that I've been able to accomplish in these short 5 years since I've been out of prison, and just looking forward to the future.
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to get into, the work that you've been doing, the work that is coming with you in the city of New Mexico and your community, city of Albuquerque, yes. And your community. But, you know, the framework of restorative justice is something that you learned rather recently. But I imagine in some way, shape, or form, you were doing this work even before you knew those words. So in your own words, how did this get started for you?
So recently, it was just, you know, like a training that I took so that I could better myself in my approach when I'm out in the streets doing interventions. But so I took a training. I met one of our restorative justice gurus here in Albuquerque, and I took her training, and it was very interesting. You know, like I really love the concept of being of the victimizer and the victim being able to heal together one another. You know, it was just a powerful. A powerful, interesting model to me. I had never heard of restorative justice before I got into the work, but, you know, kind of like what you said right now, you were probably doing it before you even got into this field. Yeah, I could kind of remember like being a kid and bringing two friends together that weren't really talking and like, hey, man, you guys got to talk this out, you know, because we're friends. So, but I didn't, you know, I didn't know I was doing restorative justice back then. But, you know, this was in the hood with my homeboys. So, but yeah, no, like it intrigued me a lot. So when I saw the NACJR conference, I was like, no, I have to go to this, you know, I have to meet more people. I have to like hear their experiences. And it was very rewarding being there.
Yeah. You know, there's one thing about like getting formal training, which you have recently. We'll come back to that in a second. But I want to go back to, you know, when you were a kid, bringing your friends together, right? Like that's not everybody's inclination. Not everybody plays that peacemaker role. Where was that modeled for you, or what inspired you to do that?
Well, to me, honestly, back then it was like, okay, these are my friends. I don't want to be stuck in the middle. Like these dudes are over here fighting with each other, and oh, you're gonna go kick it with that dude? Oh, I'm not gonna go. You know, like I didn't want to have to choose. So in my mind, what it instinctively came to me was like, all right, I gotta get these dudes together so they can figure it out, and that way I'm not just stuck in the middle. Like, all right, who am I gonna hang out with today? And we can all just hang out again. You know?
Yeah. Are there any particular incidents that like stand out to you, and like the way that you help them come back together?
Yeah, you know, so it was over a girl. These dudes were arguing, and you know, they were arguing, and every time I'd be with one, he'll be like trying to sway me not to hang out with the other one. Then I go hang out with the other one, and the same thing, you know, like, oh, why are you hanging out with that dude? And I just got tired of it, you know. And I told each one of them to meet me at my house, but I didn't tell them that the other one was coming. So we went to my backyard. So one of them got there first, and he went to the backyard, and then the other one got there, and he just stood by the door. I go, man, come here, man. Like, enough's enough, man. Look, we're friends. And we were only like 14 at the time, you know? So I'm like, man, look, man, we're friends. Neither one of you dudes is going to marry this girl. Like, why the hell are you guys over here? Like, talk it out, man, or whatever has to happen here, let it happen here. But we're all walking out of here friends.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, no, and they talked about it, and yeah, they hugged it out, and that's it. You know, we were off and running again, being friends.
Yeah, no, I mean, and sometimes it's that simple. There are definitely things where I'm like, oh, like in other instances where like, I didn't know that this person was going to be here. How could you bring them here? Like, yeah, how could you be with this person? Like that could go left, but because of like the relationship that you had with both of them, trust that you had with both of them, it allowed that situation to go like maybe in a better way. I'm curious, like as this peacemaker, right, in those situations, you've come out of your experience being incarcerated, like wanting to do this work. So, you know, you went through this experience being incarcerated for a good chunk of time, and you decided to come out and do this kind of work. What about either your experience or inside and the life that you lived in between now and then inspired you to keep going in this way?
So, you know, like, I'm not going to lie, like, in my past life, yeah, things were very violent, you know, like confrontational. But also, there's an old Mexican saying called, it says, hablando se entiende la gente. Like, if you talk, you can understand one another, you know? Mm-hmm. So, like, even in the prison yard, like, some of the homies, one of the homies will be just bad-mouthing another one. When I knew that this dude didn't really know him. So when this dude was walking by, I'd kind of do it like in a messed up way. But either way, at the end, they would end up being friends. I'm not going to lie to you. Like the way I went about it, they would end up fighting. But at the end, they would actually like I'd call them over. And then when this dude's right here, I'll be like, hey, what were you saying about this dude? So they'll end up fighting about it. But at the end, they we all know we're all more the same, that we're different, you know, we're all more alike than we're actually different. So we'd always end up eating together, playing cards together, and it just makes it for a better time. Because like me, I hate tension, I hate animosity, like, yeah. So, but funny story though, like when I got out of prison, I didn't know that I was gonna go in this direction. Like when I got out and I moved, because I'm from California, I'm from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So when I paroled, I stayed with my mom in Long Beach for a couple of days, and then I moved out here to Albuquerque. And when I got here, so my uncle, he's a professor at UNM, so he gave me the opportunity to try to change it up for myself. So he made me enroll at the community college here in Albuquerque. So I decided that electrical trades was probably the best way for me to go to start making money, decent money, fairly quickly. Mm-hmm. Because I was 33 at the time, you know, so I didn't really have the luxury of time. But, you know, I kept rocking it at school, kept making the dean's list, and they invited me to join this honor society for two-year colleges called Phi Theta Kappa. Well, when I got involved with them, one of their big hallmarks is service. So they go out in the community and they do a bunch of stuff like food pantries, helping out community. And after my first community event, man, it felt good, you know, like I felt good about myself, you know, like the people that we were helping coming up to me and telling me, oh, thanks, you know, thank you for all the help. And I wasn't used to that, you know, like, because sometimes, like, I'm heavily tattooed, you know, from head to toe, my hands, everything, like my legs. Like, sometimes I might look unapproachable, you know, like some people might not want to approach me. But I don't know, that felt good, like somebody actually thanking me for doing something good. So I kept pursuing that feeling. And I got the opportunity to get involved with student government. When I joined that, it gave me the platform to try to do something more. And I wanted to do something for people, students in particular, who have been just systems impacted, who have been involved in the criminal justice system. So I joined a faculty committee, and then we implemented a resource center for students with criminal records.
Yeah.
In the process of all of that, you know, I talk at events at the community college of why this was so important and necessary for someone like me, the support, the encouragement. And in me doing all of these talks and all of these presentations, the mayor, this was 2019, the mayor of Albuquerque was researching group violence intervention models. Mm-hmm. And part of the motto is having a person, a credible messenger with lived experience. So at that point, I knew that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Help systems impacted people, help create policy that after we do our time, you know, like not keep paying for our mistakes for the rest of our lives. You know what I mean? So I just didn't know how I was going to get into it. And during winter break 2019, you know, by the grace of God, I get an email if I wanted an interview for a possible employment position with the city of Albuquerque. Mm-hmm. And I interviewed, and there was four candidates, and they chose me. So I've been doing this work now for like 2 years and a half.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to go back to, you know, coming out, and like having your uncle, you're like, yo, you need to come out here. A lot of times when we think about like the restorative justice broadly, it is about like repair of harm processes, being bringing people together to like solve the problems between them. That's important. That's important work. That is restorative. And sometimes the steps to get to that place like involve like people in your community just saying like, hey, like what is it that you need? How can I support you? What And sometimes people aren't always ready to take that help. What was it about like, you know, you and your uncle and what was going on back here in Long Beach? I'm in Pico Rivera, so not that far from where you were staying. What was it about like, you know, like I need this change. I need to go out here. I'm gonna take my uncle up on this thing.
So the whole thing that kind of pushed me over the edge about wanting to do something different was, I was raised mostly by by my mother, because even when my dad was around, he wasn't around, you know what I mean? So raised by a single mother on welfare, worked her ass off to provide. I'm a big mama's boy, you know. I love my mom. I respect her. But one of the inmates on my last prison term, his mom died, and I've known this dude from my second prison term. At that point, when I bumped into him again, I was on my fourth. So this dude was always live, cracking jokes, like real fun dude to be around, you know. He was a It's funny because he was a skinhead, but he was real funny, you know. And I'd always like to go talk to him, but he flipped out. His mom died. He had an episode, you know, a episode of psychosis, and he flipped out. And that's kind of like what opened my eyes. I did not want that to be me, and I didn't want to be selfish to the point where I'm just doing me, and my mom is out here dying, and I'm in prison, and then she passes away, and me not be able to do anything for her. So that's kind of like what pushed me over the edge on wanting to change. I just didn't know how. So it was actually my mother who suggested, why don't you move to New Mexico with your uncle? And me and him had gotten into words when I was younger. So I honestly didn't think that he would say yes. So I told her, well, ask him. If he says yeah, then I'll go out there. And he said yeah. So I came out here, and first thing he told me when I got in his car when he picked me up was like, look, I know you're grown, but you're gonna go to college if you're gonna live in my house. And I'm glad he did, you know, like that changed my whole life. You know, because sometimes we want to change, we just don't know how. Like, we don't know anything other than what we know. So I don't know if you remember. So like when I was talking, when we were together in that session, that remember that's what I was talking about, kind of like just being that, trying to be that guiding light for people. Like, but first and foremost, like repairing the relationship with themselves, you know, knowing that they matter, and getting them to care about themselves in order to push forward with everything else is what I try to do. That's why I went to that non-traditional restorative justice, because I'm trying to restore the relationships with themselves, kind of like I had to with myself, you know?
Yeah, I think a lot about how, to your point, like people aren't always ready. And like if somebody approached you at a different time with these ideas, like you might not have been ready, right? If you hadn't seen that other person like go through this episode with their mom. As you're doing this work now, right? How do you keep that in mind as you're approaching folks who it's not just like folks who have been incarcerated, right? You're talking about like people who haven't gotten to that point yet, young people who haven't gotten to that point yet. Like, how do you keep that in mind in the way that you do your work?
So the way I approach it is, I'm not a savior. I'm a gardener. I'm just gonna plant this seed. You might not be ready, but when you are, then we can start watering that seed until it blossoms, you know. Like, as I tell people all the time, you know, like I personally understand that you're not going to make a change until you're ready for it.
Yeah.
But when you're ready for it, I want you to understand that I'll be there. And here's my number. Save it. If you don't call me tomorrow, you don't call me next week, call me next year. You know, and it's happened where people call me 6-7 months down the line, you know.
Yeah. And I think like we've skipped around a little bit. So like I want to make sure that like we're making the connections for folks, right? When you went, I do want to explore like the resource center that you helped start for students who had been formerly incarcerated, but like okay. The work that you're doing now with the mayor's office, right? As like credible messengers, like what does that program look like?
So it's called the Violence Intervention Program, and it's a public health approach to addressing gun violence.
Yeah.
So we're trying to reduce the cycles of violence, recidivism, by addressing the underlying root causes of why people are doing what they're doing. You know, whether it's substance abuse treatment, we'll put them in treatment. GED, basic needs, job training, job placement, like whatever it might be that they need, mm-hmm. those are the resources that we provide. And we don't provide them ourselves. I'm just a source of referrals, but we refer them to like community organizations who are already doing the work. But we stay on as like life coaches or mentors, and yeah. we provide peer support. But we're also their advocates. So like, if I refer somebody who historically has never wanted services, has never accepted services, if I get them to actually engage in services and they're there, and then sometimes programs have their own policies. You know, if you miss 2 consecutive appointments, then we're going to discharge you. So I have to advocate to that program, look, you have to understand that we're dealing with high-risk individuals who have never had that structure. So we have these understandings. When somebody falls off, instead of discharging them, just give us a call and we'll go back out. We'll go hit the streets. We'll look for them and we'll bring them back, you know?
Yeah. I mean, when I think about, sorry, let me look up the exact quote that you said. And well, actually, like maybe the exact quote isn't important, right? But you're talking about like, we're not going to arrest our way out of these problems, right? Yeah. Do you remember saying something? Yeah.
Yeah, no. So I always like to open up my presentations, when, especially when I'm presenting to community stakeholders or even legislators. I always tell them, look, America is the most incarcerated country in the world, with right now 6.9 million people incarcerated. And we are no safer for it. We can't arrest our way out of this problem. We can't arrest our way out of crime. We can't arrest our way out of anything. It hasn't worked. We're the most incarcerated country in the world. So what comes next? We have to find these alternate solutions or programs or individuals who are doing the work in the streets who might actually affect some change. You know, because there's a big difference from a cop approaching somebody and trying to get them to see a new way of seeing things. Or me, you know, that I've been there and I've done that. You know, like I used to have the same lens as you, homeboy, you know. But now this is what it is, you know?
Yeah. I'm always like, when you're having those conversations, what are people's reactions? Because I imagine it's different in different spaces.
Yeah, no. So usually when I go out and do interventions, it's either in the hospital or either to their homes. And the way our model works is that the first initial, except for the hospital one. The hospital one is strictly social services, but our motto is that when we go to home interventions in the community, the first time we go out with a deputy commander from Albuquerque Police Department And that's just because it's a partnership. They have their message, but the biggest part of the program is my side of it, the social services, and we have our message. But so when we first get there, you know, you have this police officer standing on your doorway. A lot of the times, as soon as he says, look, you're not in trouble, we just want to talk to you about this program, you can see like the relief wash over them. But then after that, me and my team, we make it a point to let them know, look, we don't work for them. We work in partnership with them. That this is how we get our referrals from the shooting reviews that they have. And they tell us, look, this will be a good candidate for you guys to go and help. So we explain that to them. But then that's the last time they'll ever see him. And then they'll just continue working with us. So after we explain that, they're pretty much, you know, like they've always been receptive, whether they're in their addiction at that point in time and don't want the help. That's a different story, but most of the time they're always receptive, and they know, most importantly, they know that we'll be here for them.
Yeah. To your point, like it's not always like just like on the initial ask, like especially like when it's seen as like, oh, this might be something that like the like I'm being coerced into doing because of like the circumstances, but like people are often open. Like, what does it look like once people engage in your services?
So everybody like on the crew that we go out on interventions and we do the follow-ups and that we work with the people, we've all been in the street life, you know, we've all been in prison. And there's a certain, I don't know, there's a certain quality that we develop over time where we become like, humor is what got us through prison. So yeah. We joke around, you know, just break the ice and make it just seems like, make it seem like not as heavy as the situation is, but we bring lightness to the situation to where we're all just okay. We're not all just taking ourselves serious. It's serious what we're talking about, what we're trying to do, but like we could talk about it like in a openly humorous manner. You know, we make them relax, and then at the end, we connect with them on a human level, and yeah. Then and not just that, but like. We'll talk about our past at times. And then like, I've had interventions where like I'm talking and I get going, you know, and next thing, like they're tearing up and they're crying because I'm talking about the pain that we go through, you know, like the loneliness and the street life, you know? And at that point, like if you could make somebody tear up, then you pretty much got them, you know, like, they're experiencing the pain again and they don't want to feel it anymore. And they're like, okay, let's do this, you know?
Yeah. And so like when you've gotten to that point, like what is the journey that you help people or like you accompany people on as they're starting to make those changes for themselves?
I mean, whatever it may be, like we will always walk alongside someone, you know? And even if they walk a little bit in front of us and we have to push them along the path, we're willing to do that. We're just not going to walk in front of them and because they're going to get lost, you know, we're not keeping our eyes on them. But I mean, whatever it might look like, you know, sometimes they'll go to their sessions and or they'll go to work for a week and then they fall off. But we just keep in mind, like we're dealing with high risk individuals in our community and we try to celebrate any little accomplishment, you know, like if I tell them I'm gonna pick you up at 8 so I could take you here and they're ready by 8, that's being, you know, responsible. And I celebrate that with them. Hey man, I'm proud of you, you know, like take them to lunch or whatever. But most importantly is just building up these little like accomplishments, these little things that'll make them feel good about themselves. And because I know it worked for me. The more I kept getting A's, the more I wanted to keep doing better and better and better, you know, just these little accomplishments. And the further along I got, I didn't even think about LA anymore, trying to go back or my past life, you know?
Yeah. That was a question that I was going to ask later. You just said it now. Like, is there a part of you that's like, I want to go back, not to reconnect to like the past life, but to like go back to my community and do this work there where I caused a lot of harm?
Yes, definitely. Like, that's definitely in my future plans, and I want to do it. I'm just sharpening up my skills here, and because like, I'm not gonna lie to you, like, I've been 5 years removed from the life. I want to give myself more time, because you just never know. I haven't put myself in those situations where, like, I have to choose my new life, my old life. And I just want to make sure that when I do go back, I'm cemented in what I'm doing. And because, like, you build bonds with these people, with your homeboys and all that, with the streets. And like, right now, I don't know if I'd be strong enough to say, oh, he's asking me for a ride, or like, I probably, knowing damn well he has a gun and he shouldn't be in my car, but right now I'd probably be like, okay, hurry up, I will drop you off. And then just from this block to that block, dropping him off at his grandma's house or something, boom, cops are gonna pull up. Anything can happen. And all they know is me from the past. And they're gonna be like, oh, you're back. And then everything I've worked for is ruined. So those are things that I think about. But honestly, like, I do want to go back, whether I start a foundation later on or something targeting like my area. I just haven't, I'll cross that bridge when I get there, but I know definitely that I do want to go back and help out my community that I helped destroy for so many years.
I mean, and thank you for sharing that like transparently, right? Like, and I think like it's you talked about like, healing yourself. Part of that is knowing yourself and like knowing where you are in your process of healing, right? Like, I think a lot of times when people think about, restorative justice work and like this transformative way, like this isn't always quick, right? Like sometimes when we are addressing like a very specific incident of harm, right? Like we can like bring people together who are beefing over like, trying to date the same girl. Like we can squash it. Neither of us are going to marry this person. Let's move on, right? But when we're talking about habits that people have built over a long time, or systems that people have participated in for such a long time, like this is work that does take time. And just because we don't get it right, quote unquote, right, immediately, like doesn't mean it's not worth doing. I'm curious, like, you are new to like the formal framework of restorative justice. And I heard you say like, like you were like, yeah, like this is something that I can bring to the communities that I'm working with now. How have you brought our, well, I guess like first, what was it about like that training? And you can name check the person who shared it with you. That's fine. But what was it about that training that's like, oh yeah, this, and then like, how have you applied that to your work?
Her name was Tanya Covington, and she was actually with me at the conference. But yeah, like, so the way that she just talked about kind of like the history of restorative justice, stemming the root of it coming from like the Native Americans and the way that they handled their situations, like, in the past, and it like all that just it just attracted me, like the mediation, the de-escalation of things. And then I guess the most, in her training, the most powerful video that she showed us was Adam Foss. I don't know if you know who that is. He's a so he she showed us a TED Talk, Adam Foss, talking about him being a prosecutor. And this is the thing that opened my eyes. Like, I did not know how much power prosecutors have, because he said, when you're a prosecutor, you literally have these people's lives in your hands, and you could decide if you're going to lock them up and throw away the key, or you could work something out with them and try to get them on a better path. So that's what, like, kind of hit me. And when I'm out doing like my interventions, like, for me, it's like, okay, am I going to give up on this person because clearly they're not ready, or am I going to keep just being a thorn on their side so that they know that I'm here until they get ready? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just, I mean, like I said, you know, like the most important thing is for, I always try to, so the reason, I call it the reason, your reason, like, what's your reason? Like, for me, it was my mother. Mm-hmm. Like, I always ask people this, like, dude, like, is there a reason, a person, anything that you would want to switch your whole life up for? Like, so, I don't know, just for me, it's always, at least my philosophy is that everything ends and starts with me, like in my life, at least, you know, like any situation or anything. So then I have to be good with me. I have to be like at that point where, like, if I want to get healthier, I have to like just really do it for myself, you know. And I don't know, just like still right now, like I said, it's been 5 years. I'm still learning myself. I'm real self-aware, though. But I'm still learning, like, how to love myself and coping with the harm that I've done in the past. But just, I don't know, just, like, the whole concept of healing is what attracted me. Because at some point in my life, I want to feel like I'm completely healed, you know?
Mm.
And by helping others heal themselves in the community, it's cathartic for me as well. Like, it helps me heal myself.
What are the signs that you're able to like identify in yourself that like you are like not like healed like at the end of the journey, but like you're on the right path?
So, I mean, I get emotional now. I could feel. I allow myself to explore my vulnerability. Like, I allow myself to be vulnerable in front of other people. Like, in the past, like in L.A., you know, like, you know, I would drink, you know, do cocaine, smoke weed, but always some kind of numbing agent just so that I could live with myself. And it just, you know, growing up with that toxic masculinity, like, oh, men don't cry and you have to be hard. And then especially in prison, you know, like, you can't go in there and be weeping all the time. You know, you're going to be a target.
Mm-hmm.
So just like hardening my heart now, like, man, I could be watching something and like something will come on, I'll start tearing up, you know, I'll be like that, you know. So
yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's why I know, like, it's in process, I'm a work in progress. But you know, and just for the simple fact that I cry in front of people now, you know, I cried at two of the sessions in Chicago. Like, no way in hell would I have done that in the past, you know. So that's just, those are signs for me that, you know, I'm getting there. Like, I'm working on myself and I'm allowing myself most of all, like, to go along with it, you know, like, just, I'm not resisting is what I'm saying, you know, I'm not resisting the change. I know that in order for the new me and the future me to be the best me, it's going to sound crazy, but I have to kill the old me, you know, like, get rid of it.
I mean, there are lots of metaphors when we, I don't think that like this kind of transformation just happens through like restorative justice, like quote unquote, that kind of thing, like with that formal language, right? I think it's important to remember, you've said it, I say it all the time on these airwaves and in other places, like restorative justice is about relationships, right? Yeah. Healing relationships, building relationships, strengthening relationships. And the first relationship that you have is the relationship with yourself. Right, so restorative justice is about that work, but like that's not the only framework that people come to, like inner transformation. And sometimes, like, yeah, that transformation requires like, I can think of like a different religious traditions thinking about like that transformation that people have, like in a conversion experience or like an enlightenment, right? Like being able to see things differently, and then once you see things differently, you're able to practice. But it's a process, right? Like people aren't always able to jump in immediately. I'm curious. You answered the question a different way than I intended it earlier, because you were saying that like you were when you go out and share about your work with like community stakeholders, like I asked you, like, you know, how are people reacting? You took that question to mean like, how are the people that you go out and work with responding to that? I'm curious how the community stakeholders who you're presenting to are digesting that information, because I think in our communities, we see the need for you know, just something different, like not being able to arrest our way out of these problems. And there are people who are very invested in continuing that cycle of violence and oppression. So like when you're giving those presentations, like I want to ask it in the other direction, how are those people receiving that message?
So, you know what, like, I'm not even gonna lie to you. Like they always like, so I'll give you an example. And my colleague told me this. So I was on a town hall on a panel.
Sure. Uh-huh.
I was on a panel with the special agent in charge from the FBI from here,
mm-hmm.
A commander from the Albuquerque Police Department, one of the executive directors from the courts, and then it was me. You know, and the part of the town we were in. The part of town that we were in, the participants, the crowd that showed up, like the viewers,
mm-hmm.
My colleague told me, like, dude, I thought they were gonna like just gang up on you and bombard you. She goes, but it's like when we talk about the work, and most importantly, explaining why the work is important. Like, if we could get this one person to put the gun down and stop the revolving door of recidivism, like, first of all, like, it's going to impact not just this person, but his whole family.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, all it takes is one person to change the whole dynamic for their family, you know? Like, yeah. there's families that are generational gang members because one person got into a gang. Now everybody's doing it. Well, it goes the other way, too. If one person changes their life, then bam, everybody, the whole family, the dynamic changes, too. But I got to tell you, like, every time we present, everybody at the end loves the program. And they thank us for the work that we're doing. They want to know how they could get involved. And, I mean, I don't know if they're at that moment just blowing smoke and keeping the real thoughts to themselves, but most of the time they're like real congratulatory and supportive of the work.
Yeah.
And we've presented to all types of community stakeholders, like community policing councils, citizens academies, the public defender's office the other day, all types of different community based organizations, and everybody's on board. Like, I mean, I don't know if that's how it happens in other towns, but I mean, like, for here, everybody's on board with us, you know?
Yeah. What are the changes that you like? People are, so I guess I've been doing this work for a little bit longer than you've been doing it. And like, I love the energy that you're giving me, because like it's hopeful, right? And it's hard for me to be hopeful sometimes, because like these problems aren't new. And if people like opened their eyes and like had the will to change some of these things, a lot of these things would have changed a long time ago. And like, why does it take you sharing your story in that instance to like get them to be like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
This this brown person, like let's be real, like we're talking about like white people who are like, and I'm not saying like all police officers are white, all district attorneys or state's attorneys are white, and all judges are white, but I'm saying like for the most part, people who are invested in whiteness being preserved, like if they had like had this analysis and like didn't take like, oh, I know Angel, he's a good guy, he turned his life around, like if we would just like provide those resources to communities ahead of time, like these problems wouldn't exist. And so like, it's great that people are seeing light. And I want to, like, I was watching myself. I was like, you know, knowing yourself, being self-aware. I was watching myself, like, listen to you and being like, yeah, but like, what is the change that's happening? Like they say that to your face, right? And I don't know Albuquerque. I don't know New Mexico well. What is the change that you have seen since you've been doing this work, like on a systems level, on a policy level, on a resource allocation level?
So definitely, like, at least for our program, we definitely try not to put more money into one of my coworkers said it best, the nonprofit industrial complex, mm-hmm. where these big nonprofits who have the grant writers and everything get all the money, but then they don't really do the work. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that definitely we're trying to switch up here, getting the money to the people who are gonna do the work. Mm-hmm. So also meeting with legislators. So this year, we've been trying to pass it for 3 years since the inception of the program. But this year, HB 96 finally passed House Bill 96, which was to get money from the legislature to implement a statewide Office of Violence Intervention, mm-hmm. and to get some monies here for us. But most importantly, I think that the change and the perception that we're changing, starting like my colleagues, myself, and the Office of Peer Recovery and Engagement, there's here in New Mexico, we have what are called community peer support workers, CPSWs. Okay. And we're all people with lived experience. So I think that the shift that is starting to be noticed, because more people like ourselves are getting more and more good opportunities of employment. I think the shift that is being made here is that they're finally realizing the value of life experience. You know, like, yeah. somebody who has a PhD and has been in college for 10 years is in no way gonna do the amount, or like in no way is gonna have the type of impact that a person that ran around in the streets for 20 years is gonna have. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So yeah. I think that that's a definite shift. And because I have these old white people walking up to me all the time, giving me hugs and shaking my hand and just wanting to be in the Angel Garcia business, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a big shift, you know? Like, instead of walking away, crossing the street, clutching their purses, because I'm about that, you know, like, you know what I mean? Like, so I think that's a major shift that's happening. Like, we're finally being recognized that, okay, we made a mistake. Now we're rectifying it and we're trying to help other people change theirs as well.
Yeah,
I think that's the biggest shift that I could notice, that we're getting more props and our life experience is finally being seen as a thing of value, not as a, oh, he's a ex, you know, it's oh, he's an ex-felon and now he's doing, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I am, again, like watching myself and like listening back to like our conversation that we've just had, like celebrate the small things, right? Like David, like these things matter, right? Like you having that experience of people like wanting to work with you now, like being in the business of like, oh, like this guy can really get things done. Like, yeah, of course this guy can get things done. Like why wouldn't you think that? But like, hey, it's a win that they see that. I think I have a lot of energy and like resentment and cynicism for people who like will say that in one moment, like mean it the next moment. And then like when it like at the slightest deviation of like, oh, like, I don't know, like then either like funding gets pulled or like all these other things, they revert back to the way that they know to do things. How do you, yeah, I guess like, how do you stay hopeful?
So, you know what it is like. So you've been doing the work longer than I have. So restorative justice was a thing that I learned maybe like a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. So
I don't need to put the words like restorative justice on it. I mean like doing like liberation work, doing okay. community work when there are systems and stakeholders like so invested in like actually keeping things the way that they are.
Oh yeah, so. So I'm hopeful because I guess maybe I still. So I didn't start paying attention to like really, really, really like the state of things maybe until like 3 years ago. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've always known that the 13th Amendment said that it's about abolishment of slavery and involuntary servitude, except as a form of punishment. I've always known that, but now I recognize that that's where the laws to mass incarcerate Black and brown people for them to still get their free labor. Well, that was the loophole, you know? So, like, now I'm paying more attention to, I mean, I guess I could say that I'm hopeful because I'm in the work now. And now, like, I'm not fighting against the system. I'm working with it. And with that, like, I've always been an optimist. I have to be an optimist because I don't want to feel like I'm just going to waste the rest of my life and I'm not going to change one damn thing. You know what I mean? So right now I'm actually in the process of applying for a full pardon from Mr. Newsom, you know?
Yeah.
So I have to do that because I'm going to get into the politics. I can't run as a felon. So, and I'm just hopeful because I, as people in Washington and all around the country start aging out, you know what I mean? And it's politics are going to get younger. And that's what keeps me hopeful. Like somebody like you is going to get in there and then more people like you.
Absolutely not. But somebody like, yes, not yeah, me. Somebody you know, like, yeah.
Yeah. You know, your age. And also like I've met a bunch of awesome young individuals here in Albuquerque who are getting into restorative justice work, who are purposely going to law school, and who are, you know what I mean? Like, so that gives me hope. And all I could do is like, man, just root for them and try to help them out as much as I can. But definitely, I'm going to get in. I'm going to jump in, man, head first into the politics. I think I want to. I think I have to. So I have to stay optimistic. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think, like, I wouldn't be doing this work either if I didn't think, like, it could be impactful or make a change. I think, like, my view of, like, the rate of things changing is a little bit different, right? Because yeah. I see like these initiatives pop up and like lose funding based off of like you know, quote unquote success of a program. And I'm not saying that like everybody who is doing violence interrupter work is doing a great job of it. Most of them are, right? Many of them are. Not everybody who's doing credible messenger work is like doing the best that it could be, but like at minimum, like it's employing somebody, right? Yeah. Who like could be doing something else pretty destructive. And like it's probably preventing some violence in communities. Those programs lose funding all the time based off of like political will and like whoever is like holding elected office or whoever is like choosing to fund this thing at a time. And so I don't have a lot of faith in like those systems like being the source of like our liberation. And so like when I think about my work and like amplifying restorative justice work, it is about community, giving people in community the skills to be able to do this proactively, preventatively. That's longer work. That's not like an election cycle work. That's not like the term of like, that's not like a grant cycle's work. It's about how are we building capacity in community to make sure that folks have the skills to navigate this conflict and harm between each other, but also like proactively build those relationships, like celebrate the small wins. I think it's both. And I think I've been let down and seen a lot of harm or like people not follow through in those systems. This is like, that's where this energy is coming from.
Yeah. No. And No, still, like, I know I totally agree with you. And I guess I could also say that in my position, I've been a little shielded or protected from, because we have a deputy director, we have a division manager, program manager, you know, and they're the ones that deal with the heavy, heavy red tape and bureaucracy.
Yeah.
So I might be a little protective as a, but also, like I said, you know, like you've definitely have been aware. I mean, I've been aware too, but I was living, other than the criminal justice, I was doing my own thing. I was worried about not getting killed on a daily basis, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So I didn't have time to think about all that stuff. No, but I definitely get you, you know, like government, any government is not really, especially like our national government, you know, like it should be not we the people, it should be we the corporations, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I totally fully understand all that, like the way ghettos are formed, redlining, ghettos are franchises, you know, like predatory lending and everything that affects us.
Mm-hmm.
But other than civil unrest, I don't see it, like I have to try to do my part to try to bring a voice to the legislator from somebody like me, you know. That's what I'm trying to do. Like, I'm gonna go up there and hey, just speak my mind, you know. And now we have somebody to represent, like the people who have never been represented, at least. It might, maybe I'm wishing on a star here, but for now, that's the plan, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think it's wrong to be hopeful. So, I mean, like, you have dreams of, like, going back to LA. You have dreams of political office. But, like, what is, like, next? Like, present day, like, what comes next for you?
So, for now, I'm in the, I guess you could say, I'm in maintenance stage. Right now I'm trying to maintain what I'm working towards right now. So I'm at the university now, working on my bachelor's degree. I definitely don't plan to stop till I have my PhD, you know, and that's just another goal that I set for myself. But right now I'm just like in maintenance mode, and I maintaining my household, maintaining myself. I moved my mother out here, so she's here helping her out, you know, making sure she lives out the rest of her days comfortably. Not that she's going anywhere anytime soon, but you know, like, just
yeah,
I want to be there for her the way she was always there for me. So and yeah, and just right now still keep making that impact in the community, but most importantly, like you said, you know, with those community stakeholders, where just changing their minds, you know, just making them look like, look, man, there's other ways. We don't have to stay grounded in these ancient beliefs.
Yeah. As we've heard, so much about doing this work is the practice, but it's always great to have some fundamentals. So if you want to tap into the Intro to RJ Racial and Restorative Justice course, the link to engage in that learning is in the show notes. If you want to go deeper in your practice or explore other aspects of doing work that is restorative and building a better world for future generations, we have learning opportunities for you too, both in courses and live workshops. If you're in a community, school, or organization that would benefit from this learning, we're more than happy to get on a call with you to talk about how we can support this work in your context. In addition to rating, reviewing, and subscribing to this podcast, amplification of this work also means sharing these learning opportunities with others. So if there are individuals in your life who you want to really know this work in a deep and meaningful way, and you've found the things that you've heard here on this podcast really relevant, please send them our way. It's how we literally amplify the work. Now back to the questions that everybody answers when they come on these airwaves. We've talked around it a little bit, but in your own words, define restorative justice.
So these are not going to be my own words, because I have to give credit where credit's due. There was a young lady in one of the breakout sessions. Like, to me, before restorative justice was, like you said, just repairing and healing relationships so that you can live in harmony with yourself, with everybody else. But I heard a quote, and I'm going to read it to you. I wrote it down in my notes.
Yeah.
I heard a quote this young lady said, and it just, oh, man, it just, it. So the quote is, the goal of restorative justice is not to humanize systems, but to desystemize humans. The goal of restorative justice is not to humanize systems, but to desystemize humans. So now, like, the whole view of restorative justice has become this for me. Like, yes, how, even though, yes, like, man, we're trapped by the system, how do we help people not feel that so that they could go on to live prosperous in their own way and healthy and in harmony in their own way? You know, like, I don't know. Maybe you have the answer. I don't. I'm working on it, though.
No, that was good. I appreciate it. And I think, like, right, giving us the capacity to do this work, to live, to meet community needs. Another one of my mentors, Cheryl Graves, who wasn't at the conference. She had COVID, unfortunately. But she is episode number one of this podcast. You know, sometimes simplifies restorative justice as, like, asking the questions like, how are you and what do you need, and being able to respond to those needs for people in community. And that's it. That's all that we're trying to do. I love that. As you've been doing this work, and, like, we've been talking about, like, violence prevention or restorative justice specifically, like, what's been, like, an oh shit moment and what did you learn from it?
Let me see. So revolving my work or just RJ in
your work? Yeah.
So one of those oh shit moments for me was, like, and this is where kind of, like, I had to, like, relearn too, and, like, kind of, you, like, what the need of the person is, making me more reflective on that, you know, because I work with a lot of young men right now, and a lot of them, they're, like, group involved, and they're acting like gang members and want to be, like, live in that lifestyle. And I found myself kind of talking to them or treating them that way, and very bluntly, you know, like, very matter of factly, without sugarcoating things. And I turned around, I was transporting a kid. I took him to lunch because I hadn't seen him in a while. And he was telling me all these little stories about the street and all that. And, like, so I hurt his feelings pretty much, you know, and that's not what I'm out here trying to do, you know, like, my do no harm is one of our oaths as a community peer support worker. And that was one of those aha moments for me, like, oh shit, like, I have to be more vigilant on how I talk to these little individuals, because at the end of the day, they're still kids. They're vulnerable. They want to, like, just feel loved. And, you know, like, so I apologized to him, and like, I kind of pulled him out of it, doing some motivational interviewing and all that. But it's just, like, also making sure that my old upbringing doesn't creep into my current being. Because growing up, like, nobody, like just very harshly used to, like, my homeboys used to talk to us, or even my dad, you know, and just not being that toxic man that I could be, like, just being very cognizant of that person. And so that was one of the moments that has made me feel bad in this job, you know, like, oh shit, I hurt this little dude's feelings, you know.
Yeah, there's always growth, right? There's always the ability to say, like, hey, I messed up, I'm sorry, like, and, like, repair that in that moment.
I have another one for you. This one, so, like, to me, like, I'm just doing the work. I'm trying to be there for people. I had this dude out, like, tattooed head to toe, too. He was, like, he had got shot. He pulled me to the side, and I'd been working with him a couple months. he pulled me to the side and like just straight gang member, like straight thug, you know, like done a lot of time in prison too. He gave me a hug. He gave me a hug and then he was like, Angel, had you not knocked on my door? I was waiting to heal from my wounds. Cause I was gonna go kill the guy that shot me. I know where he lives, I know who he is. And he just goes, man, thank you. So that right there, that hit me like a ton of bricks too. Like, oh my God, I'm actually making a difference out here. That was the first time where I was like, oh,
yeah.
Like it kind of like that Celine Dion song. That was the wind that gave that beneath my wings that let me soar and like, oh, smack. I'm actually like, I can make a difference out here, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Like two different versions of like, oh shit, like
yeah.
Thank you for that. This question might be tough in a different way. You get to sit in circle with four people, dead or alive. Who are they, and what is the one question you ask that circle?
I have an uncle. Well, I had an uncle. He got murdered in 1993. He was my mom's little brother. He would be one. Tupac would be another one. I would say Emiliano Zapata. He was Emiliano Zapata was one of the revolution.
The Zapatistas, yeah.
Yeah, it's him, Emiliano Zapata. And if I got one more, I would say just Al Capone, just for the hell of it. Yeah.
Okay, so what is the one question that you would ask all of them sitting in a circle?
What drove you? Like, what was your inspiration? Like, what was your vision? Like, what drove you? Like, what were you driving towards before everything went to shit? Before you got, you know, like, what was your, like, you know what I mean? Like, what kept you guys going? And just be interested to hear what they say. Like, what was your vision? Like, what was your inspiration, your driving force?
I can see, like, why you're asking most of those people that question. Like, what do you expect Al Capone's response to be?
I don't know, pasta? I don't know, like, he's an admirable dude. You know what he did? Like, just, I heard he was a good guy too. Helped out his community. You never know. Maybe all the crime he did was to help his community. And if that's the case, I would like to hear that, you know?
Yeah. Well, no, I think like, I wonder like, maybe like not what like kept you doing it, because like, I think for him specifically, it's like just trying to keep power, like trying not to get caught, like trying to maintain. But like, you know, so many gangs start just because of protection.
Yeah,
protection for community. And like, you know, so thanks for going down that with me. I guess like I get to turn that question back to you now, but like what drives you? What's you talked about, like you know, your reason, and maybe that's a rearticulation of that, but like what keeps you going now? What drives you?
So honestly, what I kind of, so when I die, I want to leave my mark on this world, you know, like from what I was to what I became, and then just trying to make sure too that I leave something behind for my family. I have a 19-year-old daughter back in LA, you know. Mm-hmm. I haven't been there for most of her life because I was in prison. Even now, like, I'm trying to repair the relationship with her. And I mean, I don't think she fully believes that I love her. And I do, you know. I do, but it's like it was my own fault. So just like leaving something behind for my nieces and nephews, like that's gonna help them and that's gonna help their families. But most importantly, I just want to leave behind the fact that if I did it, anybody could do it. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be defined by your mistakes. Or by, you know, the cards you were dealt at birth. You know, like, I became a product of my environment. And right now, like, finally, for the first time in my life, I feel like I'm driving the car. You know, I'm doing what I want to do, not what is expected of me, not what I'm supposed to be doing, or not what, like, I want to do this. So now, I don't know, just leave an example that, yeah, it could be done. No matter who you are, where you're at, what you've done, change is possible, you know? Yeah. Just using my negative past to foster positive futures.
I love it. I love it. Two more questions. This one's challenging in a different way because it requires homework. Who's one person that I should have on this podcast? And then you have to help me get them on.
Okay. Yeah. No problem at all. I'm going to say Tanya Covington.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah, it happened.
Learn from your teachers.
Yeah, no, and she's awesome. Like any little question I had, I'll just, hey Tanya, what's this? She'll tell me, like Ubuntu. I was like, what's Ubuntu?
Yeah.
She's like, oh, like real quick, boom, Unity. You know, like, yeah, she's awesome. Yeah, and I'll make that happen. I'll actually send, once we're done, I'll send an email with both of you on it.
Love it, love it, love it when that happens. And then finally, how can people support you and your work in the ways that you want to be supported?
So, it's funny, at that panel, when I was with the FBI agent and all that, one of the legislators that was hosting the panel asked me the exact same question in the same way, but she referred it to like the legislators, how can we help? The answer for her was real easy. Just cut my program a fat check and we'll take care of the rest, you know?
Yeah.
But for everybody else, I just want to say, look, crime and everything, like gun violence, it's happening in the streets, in the community. And right now, as a government employee, my whole staff, like my whole team, we recognize that the long-lasting solution isn't going to come from us, because like you said, next election cycle, the mayor is out, we might be out too. So what we really want to do is give the power back to the community, you know? The solution has to come from the community. We have to unite again. Like, I remember when I was growing up, like in the nights, like in the evenings, all the moms would be outside, you know, gossiping, talking shit or whatever they were doing. But they'd be out there. We all knew each other. The dads would be pounding a beer or two together. But we all knew each other. And if something happened in our community, we were all there for each other. You know what I mean? Faith-based leaders back in the day, they were the first people used to run to, you know? We have to get that back for our communities. We have to get that unity back. And the most importantly, right now, that me and like my crew have like this little gatekeeping power, we're going to open up the gates to give the resources to try to hand out the RFPs to the community-based organizations that are doing the real work. I was just saying, community getting more involved, like reach out, look up whatever program, whatever interests you, whatever your passion is, whether it's homelessness, juvenile detention, like trying to mitigate that. Anything, just look for a program in your community that's doing the work and volunteer. Try to get more volunteers, you know, like we have to get the community more involved. That way the community is part of the solution and they feel like they're part of the process and not just being told, look, this is what we're going to do for you and that's it. You're going to take it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so if you've got the fat check to cut, send half to Angel and send half to Amplify RJ.
There you go. Yeah.
But I really appreciate you also challenging folks, like do the work. Don't just talk about it, right? Like find the place locally to plug in and connect with community, because you know that's where these changes beyond like an election cycle will take root and make change.
Yeah, Angel, you know, and start nonprofits, like get together with LLCs, you know, start nonprofits, look for the grants. Like, man, there's so much that our communities don't know that they could do, but like, it's time we take our power back and just stop feeling helpless, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, Angel, thank you so much for coming on this Restorative Justice Life and sharing your wisdom, sharing your stories. We'll be back with another story, another episode, another conversation with someone living this Restorative Justice Life next week. Until then, take care. Like what you heard? Please subscribe, rate, review, and share this podcast on whatever platform you're using right now. Or if you're old school, tell a friend. It really helps us further amplify this work. You can also support us by following us on our social platforms, signing up for our email list, signing up for a community gathering, workshop, or course. So many options. Links to everything in the show notes or on our website, amplifyrj.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.